This is the SF Signal podcast number 9, powered by the Functional Nerds. My name is Patrick Hester. I'm an author, a blogger, and an all-around functional nerd. And tonight I'm joined by four folks who bring us SF Signal each and every week to discuss another really cool topic. Let's go down the line here and introduce everybody. First off, we have Mr. Matthew Sanborn Smith.
Hi, I'm Matthew Sanborn Smith.
Excellent.
How about that?
Excellent. And what do you do?
Let's see. I write, and I keep a hairy mango in my pocket, and I let him out every couple of weeks.
I just thought you were happy to see us. And that's gonna make sense in context to the whole subject matter here in a second. Second up, Mr. John DiNardo.
How you doing? John D. here, resident blogger at SF Signal.
Third, Mr. Jeff Patterson.
Hi, Jeff Patterson, a writer, illustrator, and my blog, Gravity Lens, can be found at baddaystudio.com.
By the way, I like the name, Gravity Lens.
Thank you.
I thought that was kind of cool. I wish I'd thought of it. And last but not least, Mr. Jay Garman.
Oh, it's definitely least, but I'm Jay Garman. I blog at jgarman.net. I am a text journalist, and I help run the Conglomeration Science Fiction Convention.
Very cool, and I thank you guys for being on. We do want to put just a caveat at the beginning of this, because we are going to be talking about sex in science fiction, and so who knows where this is going to go, and just be forewarned beforehand. So the topic tonight, what is the role of sex in science fiction? Authors Philip Jose Farmer, Robert Heinlein, and Ursula K. Le Guin, to name just a few, if I pronounced those correctly, who knows, have all had sex and sexuality in their stories in one way or another. Science fiction and fantasy is full of examples of blurred gender roles, cross-species sex, virtual sex. Are these legitimate points to move the story forward, or are they simply there to sensationalize the prose? What are some examples of sex in science fiction that, good or bad, still stick in your mind? And what are some examples where you felt it was completely out of place? Let's go to Jay Garman.
Well, in terms of at least recent examples of sex that I thought were well done, I enjoyed Charles Stross's Saturn's Children, but that sort of – it's almost a post-sexual novel for those that haven't written it. It's about basically fetish androids that exist – after humanity has died out, and they really don't know what to do with their sort of oversexed sort of personas, which I think is kind of an interesting commentary on sort of oversexed personas in science fiction in general, and, you know, when you intentionally put them out of context. But as far as sex as a larger topic in not just science fiction but all literature, I would consider it just a tool of the story, no pun intended, that, you know, it can be used properly or improperly. You know, it's a part of human existence. It's a part of the human condition. So, you know, it's certainly worthy of commentary. But it's also guaranteed to goad sales. You know, I don't think anybody hasn't walked down the aisle of their local bookstore and gone through the science fiction section and seen a great number of scantily clad women on the covers of books and wondered exactly what that has to do with the story. You know,
hey, you know what? I mean, one of the things that they've always said is that sex sells.
Absolutely. And just as sort of a completely non sequitur commentary, I don't know what it is recently. Maybe it has something to do with sort of the paranormal romance genre really coming off. But it what's with all the tramp stamps? Like, I can't go more than four books down the aisle and not see some sort of lower back tattoo on on a midriff-bared woman, you know, and get seen from the back looking over the shoulder, usually with a crossbow, you know, but they've all got to have, you know, tramp stamp tattoos. Like, is that sort of like the new, you know, gorilla on the comic book cover that's guaranteed to make you pick it up?
The answer is that you noticed it.
Fair
exactly.
Point. I answered my own question.
And since you've spoken up, John, what's your take on this?
Science fiction is used to explore lots of aspects of life and society. And so, yeah, I think sex is fair game. I think it's, you know, it works best when it's integral to the story. I don't recall any books I've read where the sex was gratuitous per se. I can think of two examples, one recent, one not so recent. A recent one was Lucius Shepard's Trujillo, which was an excellent novel, and sex scenes were used to portray the depravity of the characters. I thought it was just well done, and I seem to remember, although I guess I don't remember the scene so much in Richard Morgan's Altered Carbon so much as I remember writing about it in the review that it was very graphic. But you know, I think there's a place for it, and I think there's more movies that have gratuitous sex scenes than books. I mean, that's when I think of gratuity, I think, you know, there's lots of in mainstream movies, I should say, not sci-fi films. But
yes, and as we all know, sex in a movie or a television show is usually followed up by something really bad happening to you.
Like, is that herpes? How the Matrix sequels like opened with a sex scene? Because pretty much everything that followed that was bad.
Matthew, what's your take?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, sex is a part of life if you're lucky, and therefore it should be a part of fiction. And, you know, it can be done poorly or done well, like everything else can be done. My example of a book would be Dawn by Octavia Butler. It's part of a three-book series. Used to be called Xenogenesis, and then it was called Lilith's Brood. Anyway, humanity wipes out 80% of itself militarily somehow, and aliens come down and scoop up some of their survivors, and these aliens have three sexes. They have male, female, and something called Uloi or something like that. And the Uloi kind of like go between the male and female and exchange DNA. And these aliens can do that with each other, but they can also do that with life that's alien to them. So we've got some humans there, and the Uloi have these big, like, long tentacles that are sort of like tubes, and they hook up to the mommy and daddy parts, and then it's a DNA swap shop from there on. And that genuinely disturbed me. It was a life-changing book in that it turned me off to threesomes totally.
And I don't know how old that book is.
I think it maybe around 1980 or something.
I was going to say, because I've seen, I can't remember off the top of my head where, but I've seen something similar to that in, oh, I want to say
87.
Star Trek.
87 was when it came out.
It seemed like there was a race in Star Trek that had a third gender. I'm not 100% sure on that.
Well, I can't believe they would have stolen an idea.
Yeah, Babylon 5.
I can't believe they would have stolen just one idea.
Yeah, that's why I said Babylon 5. Jeff Patterson, what are you thinking?
Well, I just want to start off by saying that I'm currently transmitting from a decommissioned orgasmatron. I am here with my surplus pleasure unit awaiting the onset of Ponfar. So when I was 14 years old, I bought...
Okay, just a moment. If anyone who got all of those references may not have actually had sex, I think is the issue here.
I'm suddenly reminded of the Big Bang Theory before the Star Trek movie came out, where they're talking about, you know, all the things they're supposedly going to be in. They're like, oh, it's going to show Spock's birth. And someone said, I'd rather see Spock's conception. And then that led to a big, long conversation about Ponfar. Anyway, go ahead, Jeff.
When I was 14 years old, I bought Gateway by Frederick Pohl. And I was about halfway through the book and having my mind totally blown. It was the mid-70s. When one of the characters mentions that two of the other characters who are homosexuals were engaging in anal sex. This was the first time I had ever read those two words together, and I sort of dropped the book and crawled away into a corner because I had never really considered it. There were two things came out of it, came out of that particular experience. Number one, I now had a better understanding of homosexuality. I at least in my, you know, early teen comprehension as it was. And secondly, for the longest time, anal sex became sort of tied with science fiction to me because that was the only place I had ever seen it, you know, mentioned. The other book that always stood out for me was Aristoi by Walter John Williams. The protagonist, Gabriel, when the story opens for him, we see him using advanced biomedical technology to impregnate one of his male lovers. And their relationship during the course of the story, I just thought was kind of a real, it wasn't particularly gender bending, but it did really add a lot to the relationship that they have during the course of the story. And that was the one that always stands out for me.
So, two things. Number one, our listeners are going to realize, by now that there's only guys on this podcast tonight. That isn't on purpose. We actually had two of the ladies scheduled to be on, and then kind of things fell apart and they weren't able to be on. So just wanted to throw that out there. They did want to talk about this as well. Number two, my thought and what I want to throw out there and ask you guys is, for a very long time, science fiction was seen as kind of a fringe thing, kind of a geek thing, and really, you know, a boy geek kind of thing. So what I'm wondering is, you know, Jay mentions the covers with the scantily clad ladies on it, with the tattoos that are placed in seductive kind of spots. If you have a scene, you know, with sex in it, is this, you know, trying to target a specific demographic?
Well,
Jay, go for it.
I think previously it was, but you know, if you read some of the demographics of readers in general, they're predominantly female across genres, including science fiction, in terms of just reading prose. So I don't know if that's true anymore. I think the larger issue is a lot of the guys writing science fiction sex scenes, especially like classic stuff. I mean, this is no necessarily direct dig on, say, Larry Niven, but they wrote about it very mechanically. You know, I don't think they may be targeting guys, but I really hope guys weren't getting anything, especially from classic science fiction, sort of notions of how sex is supposed to work. Because either you think it's a very mechanical act, or if you've read a lot of Heinlein, you seem to think that there are a whole lot of cults of women that are just waiting to have sex with you. Which
Whoa. Are you saying that that's not true?
Many of those were related to the protagonist.
That's true. That's true.
That has not been true. If I have been misled, I'm going to have a very stern talk with my high school guidance counselor.
Jeff Patterson, what do you think?
The tipping point for me, I mean, well, number one, you look at, I mean, just old pulp covers constantly had women in bodices being threatened by aliens. And yes, that was obviously a marketing ploy. The turning point for sex in SF, in my mind, really goes to the New Wave. Because number one, it took much more of a center stage. And number two, it tended to be treated far more organically during that period as well, as opposed to the mechanical stuff that was mentioned.
Okay. Matthew?
What was the question again?
As far as, I mean, do you think that it's was targeted at a specific demographic? I mean, do you think that it was put in there specifically to try to draw, you know...
Well, yeah. I mean, originally it was, you know, adolescent boys who were the primary readers of science fiction. Now, you know, with all the urban fantasy stuff, all the girls with the tattoos, I think that's actually aimed towards women.
I was going to actually mention that I think that the urban fantasy, a lot of that market is more geared towards women. So it's interesting that they do the covers that they do. But then again, maybe maybe that sells just as well. No matter, you know, who is looking at the cover.
We got to assume it works, right? I think we got to assume it works. They keep doing it. So, you know, I'm assuming that they got some sort of marketing data that says that's the right thing to do.
Okay. I mean, you know, I'm thinking as far as you were talking about the really exploitive scenes, you know, Hollywood is ripe with that kind of stuff. It always happens in movies. It always happens. You know, it's like the movie's moving right along, and then it's all of a sudden, oh, look, we're in this room, and hey, there's the couch, and let's see what happens here. And then the murderer comes in and kills everybody, or the aliens start blowing stuff up. I think a good example of something that, I wonder how well it would have done if they hadn't had sex in it was that movie Species. Everybody remember that?
Yeah.
First off, without sex in it, it would have been like 11 minutes long.
Yeah.
I agree with your point there, but I almost think, you know, and I'm a closet fan of Species, that the whole point of that movie was it was so egregious in its gratuitous sexuality. I have to think that was a conscious parody, that they were actually saying at this point, you know, we've always sort of sublimated or, you know, other things as a metaphor for sex in science fiction, or that sex was some sort of morality metaphor within, you know, the sci-fi or slasher genres. We're just going to push that all the way to the wall, is that this is literally a sexual predator from outer space.
Well, one thing I'd like to add to that, too, is that sex has always played a very central role in horror. Much more than SF. I mean, at least on the surface, you know, all the way back to Dracula and the whole idea of sex constantly leading to something horrible happening or something horrible happening during the act of sex, things changing and transforming and stuff like that. You know, I mean, Stephen King and Clive Barker, their books are rife with it.
Well, and Joss Whedon loves to do that, too.
I think that's inherent in the genre because horror, you know, gets people excited, and I mean they both get the blood pumping,
it's about vulnerability as well, you know. I mean, but you look at something like that, and then you look at I have to mention it, like the John Norman Gore novels, which have nothing to do with vulnerability. to be kind.
Okay, so you know, we've talked about some different examples. We've talked about stuff that has stood out in your mind, good or bad. Have you ever had something where you're reading along and everything's kind of going great, and you just go, you know, suddenly there's a sex scene, and you're just thinking to yourself, why is this here? This doesn't add anything. John,
I can't recall any. I remember writing about the scene in Altered Carbon, but I don't really remember the scene itself at this point.
Jeff?
It's a novel by A.A. Atanasio, and I cannot for the life of me think of what it was. It was one of the Radix series, and there's a character who we are supposed to be feeling sorry for the first two acts of the book, and as the story goes on, he manages to have sex act after sex act, and it wasn't so much that they were poorly executed, it just kind of negated all the sympathy we were supposed to have for this guy. It reminded me of the old HBO show Dream On, where this guy was supposedly so utterly uptight and his life was supposed to be horrible, but every episode he had three gorgeous sex partners, and it was
like, I loved that show.
And cannot feel sorry for you, dude.
I love that show. That was a great show. But, it's not science fiction, but Californication is almost the exact same thing. I mean, it's like, yes. You know, here's this guy who he can't get his life together and he sucks and you were supposed to feel bad for him and he's having sex every 5 minutes in the show.
To be fair to that example, though, almost always the sex makes his life worse, and it's very rarely is the sex played in that particular example for, you know, titillative purposes. It's almost always comical, which to me gets to the point where we've almost gotten to where sex is so often gratuitous that we're in a almost post-sexual media environment where the fact that sex is often thrown in gratuitously becomes a metafictional point now. Like, Californication is built around that. You know, Dream On was not quite built around that, but, you know, that to me is almost where we've gotten to with sex and fiction, is that it's so pervasive that now we can make comments about how pervasive it is, ironically.
Well, you know, and when you talk about where did it stand out, in, at least in my mind, you know, Scalzi had some stuff in his Old Man's War. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, I keep thinking back to things that would, I think, be more considered horror, like Jeff said, versus science fiction. I'm thinking of The Mayfair Witches by Anne Rice. I'm thinking of the Vampire Chronicles. She had, you know, tons and tons of sex and sexuality and blurred gender roles and all kinds of stuff throughout those books. But in science fiction, it's kind of, at least for me, it's a little bit harder to pinpoint. I almost want to say that I read through it and it doesn't have that impact on me.
One example that I'd like to bring up is Silver Metal Lover by Tanith Lee, which was a book wherein the young girl's coming of age, growing up, learning to deal with society, her place, what she wants to do in life, happens hand in hand with the fact that she's getting into a deeply romantic relationship with what's basically it's not a sex android, but it's an android that she ends up having a sexual relationship with. And the two of them were tied so closely that it really rang true, even though the sex in it wasn't particularly gratuitous. I thought it was a really good example of the impact that it has on young people.
I just flashed on one that I thought was terrible and it made me cringe, and that is Data with the Borg Queen.
Oh.
Ugh. And the universal groan went up.
I think
he's fully functional.
Yes, he's fully functional. But there's one that still makes me cringe a little bit. Here's a question for you guys: does it stand out more or less for you? Do you care more or less, depending on the sex of the protagonist? So if it's a female character, does that matter more? Does that matter less? If it's a male character, I mean, do you get more involved? Does it make a greater impact on you? What do you think, Matthew?
Well, gee, I don't know. I think I'm only interested in the ladies, actually. I mean, if it's a male character, not, you know, I've got nothing against homosexuality or anything, but I'm just saying, I'm more interested in the sex scene if the guy's actually having sex with a lady.
Okay. And what about you, Jay Garman?
I don't think it's the gender of the protagonist. You know, I'm pretty heteronormative in my tastes, so I don't, you know, I don't think I'm unusual in that. I think the larger issue to me has always just been the execution of the scene and whether it feels gratuitous or whether it, you know, the other thing that I always have a problem with is when I read some of the more classic stuff, sort of the notion of what is an okay sexual relationship then is not now. I mean, the one that sticks out to me is Ringworld, and not that the scenes themselves are particularly gratuitous, but they sort of go out of the way to point out that the protagonist is like over a century old and he's dating a early 20 something and having relations with her, and that no matter how much you've like bent your genes to be really young or whatnot or be virtually immortal, that still feels wrong. You know, I had some of the same reactions when I was reading Ken McLeod's Learning the World, you know, where there's large discrepancies in age between, I mean, that's maybe a personal thing with me, but that...
Well, that's because you're not 120 years old.
This is true. Well, to add something to that, though, I mean, look at Peter Hamilton, both the Night's Dawn trilogy and the Pandora Star and the current Void trilogy. I mean, just about every single character in the course of those books has sex, and we learn a lot about the character through how it's approached, whether it's approached as, you know, a predatory conquest or something that's entered into quite timidly. And to speak to the last point, especially in the Pandora Star book, where characters, you know, go away for 18 months to basically get their minds put into new young bodies, and the first thing they do is spend the next year and a half just going at it like rabbits with anyone they see. We see that particular phenomenon almost exclusively through the point of view of the female characters, and it's done very effectively. But at the same time, there's also that huge age difference. You're talking about 800-year-old women, you know, who basically go and find a first lifer who's 18 or 19 and have their way with them.
And you know what? I'm thinking more about it. Science fiction is about pushing boundaries. And I think what, you know, when authors put sex in their science fiction and fantasy books, their speculative fiction books, if you want to use that term, I think it's just a natural progression because it is about pushing boundaries. And so, you know, they want to push us and push the boundaries on sex as well. Which is greeted by silence from everybody.
I'm trying to find a way to put a joke in about Barbarella being trapped in Duran Duran's organ. It's not
okay. And on that note, I think we're going to call this one closed. Thanks, guys.
You know,
for
I can't
on.
Believe nobody made a joke about you know, this is the show that redefines hard science fiction.
I think we can't believe that you pointed out that no one didn't make a joke about that.
And please address your hate mail to John DiNardo.
And use the subject line of the sandworm is crying. No, the one-eyed snake? No.
The worms are the spice channel? Is that what we're going for here?
Oh, boy. Yep, John, you're going to get a lot of email about this one.
Yeah, it's too bad the girls couldn't join us tonight, huh?
I'm creating an email folder just for the occasion.
And that's the end of the Brokeback Mountain episode of the SF Signal podcast.
Brokeback Mountain of Madness, actually.
I'd like to thank you guys for coming on, and I think we're done. For our listeners, stay tuned because we do have an interview with Brent Weeks coming up. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Fair warning ahead of time. This week's interview with Brent Weeks is much longer than what we've done in the past, and that's because I actually went out to The Tattered Cover, which is a local independent bookstore here in Denver, and tried to interview Brent when he was here for a book signing, but he had been traveling all day, he and his wife, and they were just completely wasted. We just kind of rescheduled, and so, you know, he decided he kind of wanted to give us a little bit more time. And I kind of wanted to take a little bit more time, and we kind of get along, and so you get this longer interview this week. So a little bit longer than what you're used to if you're listening to the SF Signal podcast, more in line with the Functional Nerds kind of podcast. So just fair warning ahead of time. And plus, I did want to throw out there that he and I were doing the video chat on Skype, so we were kind of seeing each other, so... that was a little bit different as well. So here you go, the Brent Weeks interview for sfsignal.com.
Hello.
Hey, Brent.
Hey, Patrick, how's it going?
Good, how about you?
I'm doing well. Can you see me?
I can see you. But
you can't, and I can't see you.
It's only because I don't have it turned on. Hold on a second. This is actually an audio podcast.
Yes. I knew, but I wanted you to pick up my facial quirks and ticks, of course, that I have. So as to give you a particular depth of into my responses.
Can you see me now?
I can. Are we live? Or
you caught me with my Heath Ledger shirt on tonight.
That's excellent.
We are not live. No,
only have audio. So, sorry for your handicap, but he's got an excellent Joker shirt on. It's very scary, and I'm going to be looking at it for like the next hour or something. So you're really missing out.
Yes.
So is it going to be you and me tonight? Or
it looks like it. Yeah. You know, I had like six people on with me last night. And I think they're all burned out.
Excellent.
So
I was afraid I'd have to talk with Aiden tonight, and I was like, oh dear God. Just kidding, Aiden.
He cracks me up. He is part of SF Signal now. I don't know if
I saw that. So congratulations.
Yeah.
Or my apologies, one or the other. I'm not really sure which. And I saw that you had just you've taken on some new duties over at I Should Be Writing or something, yes?
That is correct, yes. Mer Lafferty put out that she needed a new producer. Mm-hmm. And being the loser that I am with no life.
And having 2 terabytes of Doom?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I went ahead and said, you know, hey, if you're willing to let me do it, I'll do it. I need to do it on the weekends, though. And she said, that's cool. And next thing I know, we've got a Dropbox, and I'm editing I Should Be Writing, which is
excellent. Awesome. Excellent. Well, congratulations.
Thank you. So let's talk about your stuff.
Okay.
Perfect. Because you got a lot of cool stuff, and I did hear your wife in the background chuckling.
Yes, she frequently does that. It keeps me sane. So, honey, go away. Go away. I'm working. Okay. Yeah, we'll see how well that works.
Yeah. So, before we get too deep into stuff, I did want to ask you, of course, going back a couple of weeks, you were traveling like crazy. Uh-huh. I think when you were here in Denver, you had been in Orlando in the morning.
Yeah, I think that's right. I've sort of forgotten exactly the sequence of events.
That's
but yes,
crazy.
It was like 9 cities in 9 days or something like that. So, and then I've just appended a visit to Bakersfield, California,
on purpose. I grew up in Fresno, so
yes, that's a very good question. Actually, it's one of these things where I got an email like a year ago from somebody who worked at a bookstore there and was like, dude, you got to come to Bakersfield. We love you here. You're amazing. And I was like, right. And then my wife has a very good friend who's getting married down there. And it's like, well, we're fairly close. And the guy did ask me like a year ago. So we might as well, make a business trip kind of thing. So
that makes sense.
There you have it.
Yeah.
But that's kind of the itinerant life of a fiction writer these days, I suppose.
You know, California's rough right now. They're having a lot of problems. Like I said, I grew up there. My second favorite teacher of all time still lives in Bakersfield and teaches college, or I think he's in the college. Yeah, I think he's teaching college there. But the point of the question was, whenever you are out and traveling, and you rent a car and you pull into a gas station, you pump your own gas, do you feel a sense of freedom?
Here's how you know that Oregon has kind of destroyed you, which I'm not a native Oregonian. When you feel a small sense of outrage at having to pump your own gas, that's when you know you're done. You're finished. You are now an Oregonian. I grew up in Montana, which is kind of at the other end of the spectrum, very much do it yourself. Like, how dare you pump my gas, you bastard? You know, that is my gas and I can handle that. Are you saying I'm not man enough to handle the gas pump? And so coming to Oregon, it was really a culture shock, like you'd plunge me back into the Middle Ages or something. But now I've grown accustomed to my life of leisure. And when it's raining outside and I just have to roll down my window a nudge and hand my plastic money through there, it's really nice. So California, again, it's like, oh, my gosh, I've been to this land before. But it's very different. Yes.
As you may be able to tell, I ask different questions. I try not to ask the same 5 questions that everybody else has already asked you.
Oh, that's good, because I'm really bad at those questions.
I did have the opportunity, obviously, to meet you in person and mm-hmm. to see you when you came out to the Tattered Cover and you had a talk. And I have to tell you, you were extremely entertaining. You were very engaging. I think it was one of the best signings I've been to.
Oh my gosh.
And that's just because, I mean, I really appreciated it. And I think everybody else really appreciated the fact that, you took the time to talk to everybody and, mm-hmm. The people who were standing in line, and my gosh, you had like 80 people, standing in line. Mm-hmm. You took the time just to chat with each and every one of them. And I thought that was awesome. So, kudos to you.
Well, thank you very much. I kind of see this like, I mean, going and signing it's sort of nerve-wracking because you never know who's going to show up or what questions they're going to ask or how it's going to end up on the internet. But, like, it's my job. And if that's the worst my job gets, like, meeting people who are excited to meet me and like my work enough to stand, two hours in line to meet me, like, if that's as bad as my job gets, like, what an awesome job I have, So I sort of see it as like, hey, I'm there for you guys. I want to make it special. I want to make it fun. And I'll do the best job I can. I'm in some really, really core ways, what I am is an entertainer. And so, like, you guys pay my salary. You bought my book. You're paying my way. So I'm there to try to make it fun for you. And really, even though I get nervous beforehand, just like probably everybody does.
Oh yeah.
It's really fun for me. I mean, people are excited about my work. That's great. It's fantastic. So yeah, and meeting like 80 people who are excited about your work is totally great. So,
and they had huge stacks of books. You know, I was thinking when he's done, he's not, you know, his hand's not going to work anymore. He's going to be just miserable.
You know, I've met a few writers and I'm fairly new to this business. I mean, I've only been doing this, like being published, for like 2 years. And I met some very well-known writers early on who were like, oh yeah, I have to get my wrist iced while I'm doing it because I have to sign so many. And I was just like, oh please, you know, oh poor you. You signed so many books. And then, you know, after you sign books for 2 hours, you're sort of like, man, my wrist is kind of tired. So it gives you a slightly different perspective. And I'm sure for guys who sign, you know, for 5 hours, it's actually like a real deal. So it makes me think a little differently of how I used to judge other authors back in the day.
Sure. You obviously you talked a little bit about your brother and different things. What made you decide to go down this road? And you know, the road to becoming a published author is paved with tons of rejection and, you know, people telling you how much you suck, you know. And I remember the first thing I ever wrote creatively was for sophomore college prep English. And I had a substitute teacher, and he gave us this assignment to write something, you know, creative, where we had a secret identity. And I wrote this thing, and the next day he raved about it, and he said how great it was, and he read it in front of the whole class. And then the regular teacher came back, he said, "Oh my God, what a piece of crap this is!"
Oh no.
So, you know, I mean, it's a long and
that's why he's teaching college rather than being a published writer himself,
right?
Just so. Shit on the dreams of young people.
Exactly.
Yeah, did I just say that?
You're fine.
Or the FCC is going to be after me.
No, this is podcasting. That's a little bit different. but I mean, it's, you know, you have to have a thick skin and you have to be prepared for all the crap that's going to come down on you. What made you decide to go down this road?
Boy, I probably give a different answer to this every time. I think it's because at base, you know, all joking aside, like, I didn't think I could be really, really happy doing anything else. It was like, I love writing fiction. I feel alive when I do it. When I do it well, I feel really, really great. And when I get to talk to people about what I've done and it has touched them in some ways, that's the best feeling in the world for me. So it's like, it's an art that I can do. And I had very similar experiences with you of I think I secretly always wanted to be a writer from, you know, I started a novel when I was very, very young, 13 years old, and probably wrote 50,000 words of this novel, which was probably, you know, everybody talks about their first novel as if it's really terrible. And of course it was, but, you know, it's probably really good for a 13-year-old.
Right.
When I was in college, I met some people who I took some classes and they thought I was good. And it was sort of like, wow, maybe I can do this. And I decided that because there was nothing else I really, really wanted to do, and because I didn't care that much about money, which partially probably has to do with the fact that I didn't have student loans to pay off.
Right.
So I didn't have the hammer of doom, right behind me. I thought, you know what, I'm going to try to do this now.
Sure.
And if I can't be a writer, if I'm not good enough, if I can't hack it, well, let's figure it out when I'm, you know, 20 years old, 25 years old, and then I can quit and still get a real job. And, you know, like if I suck at writing and it turns out that it's a terrible idea, you know, I can still be a lawyer or something soulless and buy a house someday. So my faith in that was certainly tested as all my friends started being able to afford houses.
Right.
And they had, you know, a house, a dog, and an SUV, and my wife and I had an apartment.
Hey, you didn't have a lawn to cut though. That's cool.
Exactly. No lawn, which was brilliant at the time. So I think it was that. It was just this sort of stubborn tenacity, a sort of a sense of purpose. Like, this is what I was made to do. And I hung with it. And when I really gave up on myself, my wife believed in me, and she was not willing to give up. And she had this, when you're poor, you pretty quickly get over the romance of, yeah. of like being poor. Like, oh, I want to be romantic. We'll be poor and we'll just live together on love. and after a while, that wears off and you're like, boy, it'd be nice to eat out at Wendy's every once in a while.
It's our anniversary. But, let's go to Arby's.
Exactly. And we had some of those. But she was never willing to give up. She was like, you know what? I think we're still supposed to do this. And I still think you have a gift. So let's keep at it. So we kept at it. And it was 5 years of me doing it full time, writing full time while she worked the day job full time, before I got a book contract. So it was a long stretch.
Oh yeah.
And then of course, you know, another year before the book actually comes out, and then another 6 months until you find out whether you're doing well or not. So the whole industry is about waiting, I think.
Oh yeah. So just as a side note, you buy her lots of cool stuff now, right?
I do, you know, I bought her a house.
There you go.
So that ought to be, you know, that ought to last for a while, I like to think. Yes, and I spend lots of time with her, which is really what matters to her. So when I go on book tour, she comes with me.
I saw that. I thought that was actually really awesome.
That's it's sort of you know, figuring out what matters to your spouse. And gifts don't matter as much to my wife, but the time matters. So when I travel, she travels with me. And it's really, really awesome for us, even if some people think I'm slightly strange. So,
I don't think it's strange at all. You know, I thought it was really cool. Because you talk about spending time. I mean, that's the key to a happy marriage and a long marriage. So, you know, kudos to you guys.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Have you ever had to trunk a book? I was just editing. I should be writing number, I think, 154. And Mer was talking about, you know, having this book that she loved and she'd been working on it and she'd been trying to sell it, you know, and she got to a point where she decided, I just trunk it. You know, I don't think it's ever going to make it. Have you ever had to do that?
Yes, absolutely. I have. I started a novel in college and spent 5 years on that book, and
ouch.
it really had some good story parts. And I kept putting more and more time into this, and eventually I figured out that I'd made some bad structural decisions early on, which it was my first novel. So surprise, surprise, you make some bad decisions. You know, there's a million decisions you make in writing a novel, and you know, most of them can cripple it, you know, eventually. and that's kind of what I thought I did is that the skeleton of the novel was kind of flawed, just some basic structural things. And so no matter how much I worked on fixing the muscles and fixing the skin and putting makeup on that sucker, there were just some things that did not work. And so I took that and I, it really sucks to decide that 5 years of your life was a learning experience. But that's ultimately what I did. And to salvage that as much as I could, I did something that I think was one of the smarter things I've done in my life. And I picked the most interesting, like, tiny side character from that novel, who's this guy who comes into a scene. He's threatening and scary as hell. And he's like got his own sense of morality but can kill anybody he wants to. And I sort of went, where did this guy come from? And how did he get to be this mysterious creature that he is now? And that is how I started The Way of Shadows, which is the first book of my trilogy. Yes, there it is. It looks beautiful. Again, those of you who are missing the Joker, you also just missed the great. So that became Azoth, and I was like, I want to see who this guy is and how he became this sort of creature of legend. Mm-hmm. And so that way it was sort of brilliant because I was able to, I was able to know where the world goes. Gotcha. And so I take him as a kid, like by backing it up to when Azoth is a kid and seeing who he is, I'm able to, I had already written this other novel. I'd spent 5 years in the world. I knew what happens to the various nations in the world. I knew what happened to major characters. I brought some other. I was able to track some minor characters from one series back to the original series, and so it really gave me a lot of wonderful world building as just finished, and I was able to focus on story.
Sure.
Which then I was able to sort of jump into the Way of Shadows and write it in sort of a very high speed mode that's really exciting for the reader, I think. So.
And that's a nice little segue to talk about the Night Angel trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, it's awesome that it is three books. You know, there's so many people who seem to be writing these, you know, massive mega series now. You know, it's like, oh, Sanderson's going to come out with a new, you know, 22 epic fantasy thing on top of finishing Robert Jordan, you know.
The funny thing is about that, I'm chatting with Brandon Sanderson right now on
Babble Talk.
And I'm trying to talk to him about some of those structural problems that really, really huge fantasy has. And he's a little bit cagey about about engaging some of those, you know, which I do not blame him at all for, because he's finishing up the Robert Jordan series, so he can't say anything bad about Jordan, of course, and I don't blame him at all.
Right.
Obviously there's commercial reasons for him not to, but also we owe Jordan a huge debt as guys who, you know, get to make a living writing fantasy.
And before you go on, I mean, we love Brandon for doing it, you know.
Absolutely.
God bless him. Aren't you glad it's not you? Because boy, that's not something.
Yes, I am. Yes, I am. There's these big problems with writing books that are that long, right. and my post today that I'm still struggling to write because people don't hear the intonation of your voice and know when you're just kidding. Yep. So I'm trying to give Brandon a little bit of a hard time, but like not come off like a jerk.
Okay, this is what you do. You do slash sarcasm as you begin.
Right. Right. We'll do blogger speak sort of on the Babble Clash. I should. You've got these problems of lots and lots of characters.
Right.
And once like generally I think people who write epic fantasy are good at middles. And middles are great because you can introduce plot threads and introduce characters willy-nilly. I mean, you can just throw them in there and be like, you know what? I thought of a great guy. He's going to, he's – and then you just put him in. And and then you think of another great guy, and you put him in. And you think of somebody else great, and you put them in. And then you realize to try to bring, you know, the battle to Armageddon or Tarmageddon, whichever you prefer.
Yeah, Tarmageddon?
Something like that. Is that if you give each character perspective some time, you will cover one day in 800 pages.
Right.
And that really is a serious problem. Either that or you drop half the characters.
Right. You skip Matt and you piss us all off.
Right. Or you skip Jon Snow and everybody else and you pull a George Martin.
Right.
Which is tragic in its own way. And those are just built in problems of having a huge, huge, huge cast. So I think I really, really benefited by this crappy, crappy experience that I had of writing the first Night Angel book. And I thought, this book is really saleable. Mm-hmm. And then nobody seemed interested. And and then I was debating what book to write next. And if I'd been smart, like Brandon Sanderson, I would have written a completely different book. And instead, I had no passion for writing a first book of another series. So my wife said, look, you need to write what you're passionate about. So I wrote the second book of the Night Angel series, which, of course, if the first book never sold, I was really wasting another year and a half of my life. So it was not a wise move. And then after that book was done, it was like, well, what the hell? You know, I've already gambled my whole life on this thing, so I might as well... all in. Thank you. So I actually had these books almost done by the time I got a contract. And so I think I really, really benefited by sort of the bummer that everybody in fantasy had with like these series that go on forever. And the guy says it's going to be four books. No, it's going to be six. Okay, it's going to be eight. It's going to be 12. It's going to be 14. And fans are really sick of that. So the fact that I actually had these books and I'd very clearly written them in a bit of a reaction to to those guys that I love. I love Martin. I love Jordan. I absolutely love those guys. But I, like a lot of other people, got sick of the story never being done. So I wrote it as a trilogy, and I was very disciplined about, like, this is going to end. So if I can't get it done in 3 books, you know, things are going to have to shrink. And I did have to shrink some things. And, you know, bringing a lot of threads together at the end of a book is really, really hard. It's very challenging. And cutting out the ones that really don't matter to readers versus what matters to you is hard. So anyway, I did it. I made it a trilogy. It says trilogy on the cover. You know, you're only in for 3 books at the worst, you know. So that turned out to be a really, really good thing for me. But
it is.
But it was hard. It was hard as a writer. And it's it's kind of a bummer as I'm going forward. I'm writing a new series, and it had trilogy on the cover. And I was laying out the second book, and I know the story, so I know where everything goes. And then I was like looking at the second book, going, "Oh my God, it's huge! What do I do?" And so I called up my editor, and I'm like, "Can you take trilogy off the cover? You know, because it might be 4 books." And she did. She was very, very nice to me. But it is nice to I hear from fans all the time. I won't start series anymore unless they're finished. And that's a little bit scary if you're not.
That is.
If you're a fantasy writer and, you know, you don't have a finished series, it's like, wait, you're not even going to give me a shot? Wow. Like, that's a bummer. That stinks if you're not, you know, set for life financially, which most of us are not. So there's some challenges to the legacy that some of those epic fantasy writers have left us. Like, they've left us great stories. They're still working on them, in George Martin's case.
He's under pressure, though, now. He's got HBO on his back.
That's true. He does. And I heard he's got, like, a new assistant and stuff. So I have hope. And, I mean, the guy's brilliant.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
I want to read more of his stuff. I want to read it now and not later, just like everybody else. So.
And by the way, so your wife convinced you to write the second book.
Uh-huh.
Your wife is a very wise woman, and does she have any sisters or cousins who are available?
sadly, no. But you know what? I've got a sister or two who's on the market. Oh God, I am in so much trouble. Yeah, my sister's looking at me going, "You bastard." they're 25. They're motioning me something across the neck. I'm not really sure what that is.
I think that's the international sign for keep going.
Oh yes, international sign for keep going.
Magic the Gathering.
Oh, they like to play Magic the Gathering. Yeah. I mean, these are like Geek Wonder Girls.
Yeah, I did that like 10 years ago. Oh yeah, so 10 years ago.
Oh, it's so 10 years ago. They're retro. Okay, I better stop.
You're going to get in trouble. You're going to get in trouble. Yeah. And through proxy, you're going to get me in trouble, and I don't even know them.
Perfect.
I don't need any help getting in tons and tons of trouble with women. So your wife talked you into the second book. You do the third book. Uh-huh. That's awesome. It's a trilogy. It's set. You start on the Lightbringer series. You decide that's going to be 4 books.
Since then, I've decided I am going to. No, this is not leading where you think it's leading.
Okay.
I'm almost certain I'm going to put it in 3 books.
Okay.
Just because of some of those, I guess I didn't want to. I don't want to save my fastball for book 4. You know, I don't want to hold back on the best story I can tell. So if book 2 is really big, because the story is really big, you know, my publisher won't make as much money. Tough. So I guess to me, the main thing is that I want fans to get a great story.
Sure.
And I want fans at the end of each book to be excited about buying the next book, not feel like they have to buy it because I'm 7 books in. Could you just tell me what the end of the story is?
Right.
Like that's a place where fans get upset and they just get mad and they feel like, hey, you said it's going to be 6 books. I've already bought 8 books from you, hardcover. You know, right. Like, come on, man. like what are you telling me here? So I want fans to walk away feeling really happy and be happy to come visit me at signings, you know, in Denver or wherever, rather than be like, dude, you said the book was going to be out 3 years ago or 5 years ago. What the hell? You know, like those questions aren't really fun to get, I think. So I'd really like to avoid that. And the way to avoid that is by saying, like, look, I write these books because I love them, but a writer exists in community. I mean, I write books and you guys pay me. So like, I don't think I should disregard your concerns or your feelings completely. Like, I just think it's, we make a whole together. If I was writing for myself, I just shouldn't publish.
Right. Gotcha.
You know, if just for my happiness, great. But I shouldn't expect people to pay me just for my happiness either. so that's a little bit different conception of the artist than I think a lot of other artists have. And yes, we would like to be, you know, held up and esteemed as great geniuses who just should be, you know, given millions of dollars just because we are great geniuses. And that's not quite how I think of it. So, you know, that might put me at odds with a few people. But
Maybe not. who do you think out there is writing just fantastic stuff that more people should be reading?
Let's see. I'm. You know, I haven't read as much in the last couple of years as I want to, and I'm getting back into it. I get a lot of stuff that's new. Mm-hmm. That hasn't come out yet, and the editors are like, "Hey, could you give this a blurb?"
Right.
And so I'm starting to get that now. So a lot of the reading I do is business reading, and then when I read
that,
it
means you've arrived.
Yes, I suppose so. The real bummer about it is when I read something that's really good, I can't really talk to anyone about it because it's not coming out for another year.
Right.
And when I read something that's bad, I don't want to talk about it because it's like somebody whose career is just starting, mm-hmm. and so you. What are you going to say something bad about somebody who's just starting out? You know, the guy's trying to make a living and you're just pooping all over his parade. You know, that just seems like really, really rude.
That seems like what my sophomore year college prep teacher did. No, just
there you go. Exactly. Exactly that. I suppose if you get a certain kind of joy out of that, then you'd enjoy my job right now. I've read a new guy, Hulick, Douglas Hulick, Hulick. Who's coming out in March, and he's a debut guy. He doesn't work for Orbit or anything. I don't have any like secret agenda. I don't know him at all. But I read his book. It's kind of got the gritty assassin thing going on. Except his guy's like a torturer, or he's not a torturer. But the first scene of the book, you open up and he's torturing somebody, and he works for the sort of underworld, and it's kind of very similar to the Night Angel trilogy. So if you kind of like that, Douglas Hulick, coming out in March, I believe, unless it got bumped, like everything gets bumped these days. But I think the first book's done. It's kind of got some dark humor, and he seems like a nice guy because I sent him a note saying, "Hey, I like your book. Here's a good blurb." Let's see. I'm about to start Brandon Sanderson's book. I'm reading some Ken Scholes. Just got started on that. Lamentation.
The Way of Kings, or?
Oh yeah. I'm starting The Way of Kings next.
Ah, gotcha.
So I'm reading Ken Scholes, who's I think a Portland writer. So I met him once or twice, and so it's like, oh, I got to read this guy's book. I just met, and subsequently read a short story by Mary Robinette Cole. And I read her short story, First Flight, which was really charming. I really, really enjoyed it. So I'm you know, having read that for free, I'm definitely going to check out some of her longer fiction. She's a tour author. I think she won like a Nebula or something.
Oh, nice.
for her short fiction. But she's just got one novel out, which I'm, Christy, do you remember what that novel's called?
No idea.
Ah, sorry. Sorry. My second brain failed on that one, too. So anyway, Mary Robinette Cole, K-O-W-A-L, and she's a lovely woman and I think talented writer. So those are a couple things.
Again, just to remind you.
How about you? Sorry. What am I reading? Yeah, what are you reading these days?
I just got a thing from Subterranean by Peter Brett. I think it's a novella that he wrote.
Uh-huh.
I'm called.
Is
the
that
Alchemist.
A Brain Gold or something?
Is it that one? I think I did get that, but I also got something, and I can't remember who the Alchemist. That's Paolo Bagalucci-Bukuki that I can never.
Paolo. We just call him Paolo because we love that guy.
Yes. My partner at the Functional Nerds, John Anilio, became good friends with Peter Brett, I guess, at ReaderCon.
Uh-huh.
And suddenly we both got on lists and some training started sending me stuff. So I've been kind of reading that stuff. And we've already had Peter Brett on. We want to get Paolo on. I think he said he could be on in November.
Oh, cool.
So I've got those. I've got your books sitting here to be read in my pile.
What?
That makes him smile. I have not.
You're interviewing me here? Oh my God!
Yes.
I'm totally kidding. Totally.
Hey, you know what though? Trust me. I'm not a speed reader, but I can skim and get stuff. And I did that with the first book. But now I have to read it. If that makes sense.
Sure.
Because I like to know what's going on and you know. Before I talk to you, so don't think that I completely blew you off there, man. That's not my style.
I'm just giving you a hard time. I mean, what can I do here?
not my style.
Okay, you've told me some of the stuff you've been reading, but what do you really enjoy? What's your
One of my favorite authors is Ellie Modisette.
Okay.
He, you know, even though the books are all part of like a huge series, really, they're all standalone. And you can read any one of them, and you don't have to read the rest.
Right.
I have become a fan of Mike Resnick since meeting him and talking to him and interviewing him. And I've read his Starship books from Pyre.
Okay.
Those are great. And you know, it makes me want to read anything of his that I can get my hands on. What's sad is that most bookstores don't stock his stuff, and you have to buy it online.
Right. Gosh.
You know, there's only so much room, and you know, they don't stock everything, so
right.
It's kind of sad.
It can be really frustrating, and I can speak to this as being a debut author. Like you walk into the bookstore and you're like, are they gonna have any of my stuff? And you sort of you try to be like very cool as you scan the shelves, and you're like, let's see, and you know you're working your way through the alphabet. Oh.
Abercrombie.
Nice.
Yeah. I'm showing him Joe Abercrombie here, folks.
Yes. So it can be a little bit fraught with all, you know, all your insecurities come right to the surface, and you notice they've only got the third book of your trilogy.
Right.
You're like, that's great, guys. You know, how are we going to get new fans if you don't have the first and second book?
And that always pisses me off.
It's amazing. Or you know, one large chain bookstore, which shall go unnamed, would always have like the space for my books. Like they had the shelf space and it was empty. So obviously the books were moving.
Right.
And they would just never replenish the stock. So you're like, there's obviously a demand. People are buying these books when they come in and you're not replenishing the stock. So those are books I don't sell. Like, come on, you know? And it can just like that whole like the process is probably about as efficient as it can be at this point in time, you know, this point in history. But it still certainly has inefficiencies, and it's really frustrating when you think, you know, or when you get a bunch of emails like I did of readers saying like, man, I loved your first book. I had to go to 6 bookstores to find your second.
Right.
And you're like, oh my God, you know, like for each reader that emails me saying that, how many readers were like, I can't find the second. Oh, well, here's another book over here.
Yeah.
And just jump off the thing. Or certainly a guy like a guy like Mike Resnick would feel the sting of that, of being like, dude, I'm just trying to sell some books. Can you please have them in the bookstore?
Right.
You know, my books are plenty good. Please help me out. So it can be a really frustrating kind of process.
It can be. And, you know, when you ask about me, when I go out, I do actually look for series. I look for not necessarily series. What I look for is more than one book.
Okay.
Because if I like them, I want more stuff from them.
Okay.
It doesn't have to necessarily be a series.
Right.
You know, I've picked up one shots before and read them. But you know, I like to know that there's some other stuff, and you know, that I'm not going to read something and think it's absolutely fantastic and then there's nothing else. Now, the flip side of that is you pick up the friggin' sequel to Willow written by Chris Claremont. I don't know if you ever saw that. He got an outline from Lucas and he wrote a trilogy that is a sequel to Willow.
No way.
And if you're camping and you've run out of toilet paper, and you don't have a copy of Final Crisis from DC, then keep the sequel to Willow on hand, and it's perfect for that.
You're telling me it's sure, and
it's probably biodegradable. It'll break down.
Wow, that bad, huh?
That bad, terrible.
That bad. Oh, well, there is our share of that in the fantasy shelves, we must admit. So
now,
but you're naming names, you're throwing down, you're spreading fecal matter on some guy's life work. So
what? I think Lucas had a lot to do with that. Chris Claremont has written some fantastic stuff.
Given the new Star Wars movies, probably yes, he had a lot to do with it. So
yes. Now, there's a mind meld on SF Signal that's actually asking, should Star Wars be rebooted?
Oh, jeez.
I think the overwhelming response has been no.
Yes. Okay, here's my pet theory. Like, completely unmoored from reality, probably, is actually, there's this thing on in the New York Times this week. About creative minds and how creative minds so often work in conjunction with other people. So you've got your Lennon and McCartney, right?
Yes.
And so often the creative minds that get all the plaudits are the guy, and he's married to some brilliant woman who you never hear about. That's certainly the. Well, I hope in my case it's my wife is not the woman you never hear about, but she certainly listens to my brilliant ideas and lets me know when they suck. My completely unmoored from reality theory is Lucas wrote those first three movies with his wife, and he did. I know that part is true, and she helped him with those movies, and.
Well, you know, he cut those three movies out of a longer narrative.
Yeah, yeah. Everybody says that. It's full of crap. Okay. but let's just take the work one thing at a time. I mean, I've planned 20 other books in my head. You know, and how much I've planned them is a different question. But it's good marketing for me to say, oh yeah, it's completely done in my head. I just have to write it down, which will take me 2 years.
Right.
So I dismiss that a little bit. I mean, yes, you can have story arcs of like in the first three books or in the first three movies, you have this kid and then he becomes this bad guy. Okay. Do you count that as being like all planned out in his head, or do you just say, okay, you've got a sketch?
Right.
So anyway, back to my point is that he wrote those when he was married to this woman. And he subsequently divorced her. And then he wrote these movies that were really, truly awful.
Yes.
And the movies still had what was good about the first movies, which was, they were pushing the edge of they were pushing the edge of technology. They beautiful cinematography, lots of great set pieces. You know, they did all these things well. And the thing that they did not do well was the story, which the first movies did well. And so I say you take out his wife, who he divorced, and he still does all the things that he did really well, and I think he does not then do the things that his wife probably brought heart to those first stories. So that's my That is my soapbox, and I'll get off it before I, you know, overstay my welcome.
I'm going to try to wrap you up here soon because I don't want to keep you all night. But talking about large chains that shall remain nameless, like Borders. What do you think of the teddy bears?
Oh, the teddy bears! Oh man,
they don't have room for book one and two, but they've got room for the teddy bears.
Quite honestly, Borders itself has been really good to me. So I don't want to bag on Borders at all because, they believed in my series and they've ordered books more than Barnes and Noble. Sorry, you pulled it out of me, and I've sold well for them. So you know it's been a mutually beneficial kind of arrangement. But they have given me the time of day, and they've given me, space in their books stores, certainly. The whole teddy bear thing, they find themselves in a really tough retail space. You know, people are only willing to lose money on businesses, no matter how much they love them, for a certain amount of time, and they're losing money. So what do you do? You come in with your Harvard business degree and you say, well, books aren't selling. Let's sell widgets, and whether that works, I don't have hope that teddy bears are going to save bookstores. Let's just put it that way. I would hope that that refocusing on books and exploiting, I mean, they do this as well as they can, but exploiting and finding the books that are going to sell really great and finding those early. And giving space to those books, and having their staff be really well educated, and how you do those things, and make a bottom line, and pay a guy $7 an hour. I don't exactly know. That's kind of the problem at the base of the big chain bookstores. So I can't solve that for them, but I don't have any hope for teddy bears, quite honestly. And I want Borders to stay in business.
We want bookstores. We definitely want bookstores. We want places to go where they can find stuff.
We want bookstores, and we want places where we can go and be comfortable and look at lots and lots of books and find them in that way. Because the Amazons and stuff are great, but it's fun to go into a bookstore and find hidden treasures. Yes. So. Absolutely. So I don't find, the Harry Potter dolls to be the kind of hidden treasures that I'm looking for. But clearly, a lot of people do buy those things. So that's what those chains have to look at. And so do the small independent chains. I mean, they've got lots of widgets and Moleskine kind of diaries and this and that and the other thing as well. So you can't just say that, only those big bad guys are looking for a way to turn a buck, because everybody's trying to make a living these days. So
sure.
So that's my short. What do you think? Let's throw it at you and see how you feel about it.
I ranted about it on SF Signal, and the reason I ranted about it was because the way it was announced was that they were doing this in order to bring people in to get them to buy books. And my take on that was, well, if you want people to come in and buy books, why don't you focus on books?
Mm-hmm.
You talk about having the $7 an hour person in there who really doesn't know books. Now, the difference between, at least as far as I'm concerned, a Borders and a Tattered Cover is that when I go into Borders, the same guy could be working at Best Buy.
Right.
There's no difference between his product knowledge and the guy at Best Buy. I walk into an independent bookseller, and I buy something by, Brent Weeks, and they're going to say, oh, if you really like this, you might also like this from this guy. I mean, they have knowledge. They actually read the books and they know what they're doing. So, I kind of feel like if they focused a little bit more on the books, then I think that might actually help them draw people in. If they actually had the knowledgeable staff, if they actually, spent the time on that, and if they had the Mike Resnick book, when I went to, I'm going to interview him. I knew I was going to interview him, and I thought I better go out and see. He's got these books out from Pyre. They're new books. They've been out, less than 5 years or something. I should go get them, and I went from store to store to store, and couldn't find any of them. And I ended up having to order them all online because no one was stocking them locally.
Yeah, Yeah, that sucks.
Yeah.
So I guess I just I mean, like I've gone to these places, Tattered Cover, Mysterious Galaxy, and they're so awesome. I mean, they're really, really good. And I just I don't know if you can get that kind of education at the kind of number of places that we would like
right.
to get guys.
Good
like
point.
Like those guys fill a niche. And you know, Tattered Cover is going to survive because it's Tattered Cover, you know, and Mysterious Galaxy is, it, you know, has built up all this goodwill over, you know, generations. They're gonna survive. They're gonna do well. Whether you can replicate that in every city in America, I don't know if you can. Just because the amount of knowledge and passion and love that you have is
sure.
kind of enormous. So I guess I see the slightly more dispersonal. bookstore as having a place, but I'm not
sure.
emotionally invested in that. But
and I'm not. It's not like I'm asking you to bite the hand that feeds you or anything. I mean,
right.
you know, you as an author, you want your books in every store. I mean, you want them everywhere, so everybody
put them in Safeway, put them in Buttery.
Sure. Why not?
Yes, please.
What do you think about the ebook market and how that's just exploding? Do you feel that when your hardcover comes out, should it also come out in Kindle the same day, or do you want it to wait a couple weeks?
Quite honestly, it's a mixed bag for a guy who's in the place I'm at right now in my career, which in general, disregarding my own career, I think readers should get the text in whatever way is most convenient to them, because I want people to be fascinated by my stories, period. And I will make my money off them eventually. You know, so if you read the first book of the Night Angel series and you get it for free, that's fine, because I hope that my book is good enough that I convert you to be a lifelong fan, and so that you will buy books from me and keep me going for the next 20, 30, 40 years, because you go, you know what, that book was so good, I'm going to buy the next one the day it comes out, you know, even if it costs me a little extra. And I'm totally fine with I just got a Kindle. I love it. Especially for these super fatty books like I write, like Brandon Sanderson writes, like those aren't fun to take on the plane. You know, you can't fit it in the seat back in front of you. And so it's nice to be able to have that as another option. So I'm very much in favor of ebooks, and yet at the same time, I understand where some of my colleagues are terrified of ebooks. So generally, just speaking some market share stuff, which matters to authors, generally, books sell like maybe a few percent of the number of hardcover books that you sell, sell in ebooks. So in science fiction and fantasy, it can be like 10%. Like I get 10% the ebook sales that I get in most of my books, mm-hmm. or in, you know, in my paperbacks. Okay. So when I came out with the hardcover, I in those first couple of weeks, I was selling like 30% in Kindle. Okay. So
wow.
A huge number of Kindle sales,
it is.
Huge number of ebook sales, which is great. And it doesn't count towards the New York Times bestseller list. Okay, so all those sales, which are happy fans, I hope, and yet it doesn't bump me onto the rack. So I started at number 23 on the bestseller list, which is great and wonderful, and it's my first hardcover, and it's amazing. If I'd had all those sales, if those had counted toward the New York Times bestseller list, you know, I probably would have been in the top 15, or I almost certainly would have been in the top 15. Which would have then shelved me in airports all over America.
Yeah.
So do I love the Kindle? Yes, I love the Kindle. Do I love delivering stories to fans quickly, easily, in the best way for them? Yes. Is it a complete blessing for me as a writer? No. It's a mixed blessing.
That's not necessarily. I mean, that's the New York Times being
right.
stupid. You know, like Nielsen. That's like Nielsen not paying attention to TiVo.
Right.
You know, if they paid attention to TiVo, Dollhouse would still be on.
Right, absolutely.
Battlestar Galactica would still be on.
But you know, this is the world in which we live. It's not necessarily just, you know, but yeah, you have to take the ebooks as they are. And so personally, I still fall on the side of get books, get my stories into fans' hands as easily as possible, and let them be like, oh, Brent Weeks, that sounds kind of interesting. Okay, I'll check it out. And if they can have it, you know, delivered in 60 seconds, like the commercials say, you know, and they don't have to think about it, don't have to drive to a store, don't have to not find it on the shelves, all those things are great to me. Right. But it's a mixed blessing. And there are guys, I do not share these fears, but I know guys in the business who are terrified that once ebooks become really, really popular, that the piracy will just put them out of business.
Yes, I've talked to some people. I've interviewed some people who have had that same fear. So I know that that's out there.
Yeah, yeah. So which I understand. You know, if it costs you whatever $30,000-$40,000 a year to live, and you're talking and you think you're going to lose $10,000 or $20,000 a year to piracy, then it gets really scary. So I totally understand that. I think, you know, I sort of take that long view of get good stories into as many people's hands as possible, keep telling them, and you're going to be able to make a living. So that's my philosophy.
Now,
crazy.
That's a nice little segue into how I like to wrap some of these things up.
Okay.
I know that you are an author and you like to write, but when you're traveling and you know, promoting, you don't get a lot of time to write. And so I know when we talked previously, you were saying that, you know, you weren't going to World Fantasy because you owe another book and you're dying to work on your book.
Right.
What are you on? What do you use? What's your technology? Are you Mac? Are you PC? What are you doing?
I'm PC right now.
Okay, that's the end of this podcast. And
Okay, I've got an iPad. Wow, brutal. You know, the reason for the PC is purely economical, and it's because I could replace a PC every 3 years for $300, and have a new computer that'll be fairly reliable for another 3 years, and I keep it clean, and I use Microsoft Word, but. You know, so when you're poor, $300 is doable, and $1,300 just is not. So, so I've got a little bit of inertia with the pretty that is Mac. So I got an iPad. I used that on my tour, and it was good enough. The hardware is plenty good. You know, it's powerful enough to write on. And do all the things that I do. The software is not all there for all the things that I do yet. Word processing software.
Yeah,
is
you're
getting
iPad.
There.
Yeah.
And some of the web management stuff for updating my website and stuff isn't there yet either.
Right.
But it's plenty good to bring on the road, have something to work on, play on, and so forth. So I love it. It's fun. It's not a complete laptop replacement at this point, but good enough for on the road.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. The iPad does not have the word processing software yet. If you're on the standard Mac, just OS 10.5 or something, people tend to like that version of Word better than they like the PC version.
Yeah.
Just because there's different stuff that you can do.
Okay.
But I listening to Merle Lafferty all these years, you know, I've switched to Scrivener and everything I use in Scrivener. And I know they're doing a beta on Windows. You might look into that. It's a pretty slick little piece of software for writing.
Okay. Check that out. I'm always looking for new things and different things. I tried to like write on Google Docs.
Oh,
right? And it would all like Google lets you have like 7 bajillion terabytes in your inbox, and Google Docs would only let you have 0.5 meg. And so I was trying to switch over because I was like, dang, this Microsoft Word, rah, 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 you know, and I tried to like import my document and it wouldn't do it because it was like 0.7 megabytes. I was like, you got to be kidding me. This is Google. But, you know, that. So I sort of sometimes make these abortive attempts to try different technologies. And then I'm like, look, I can't be spending days and days messing with the technology. You know, Word works.
Right.
It's not always pretty, but I know how it works. So I can't spend another 3 days messing with this. And so I just go back to, you know, doing what inputting text, which is really what I get paid for. So
are you done traveling for the year? Are you?
I hope so. I turned down the opportunity, which I'm really sort of sad about, but I needed to do, to go to New York Comic Con.
Ooh,
especially when it's like, oh, they were going to fly me out there, you know, like I didn't have to pay to go.
Dang.
My agent is a very wise man, named Don Moss. And he sort of says, look, you've only got so many weeks in a year to write. And so you need to look at your, you know, your commitments. And you don't want to be one of these writers who's at every con because they don't write.
Right.
They do a lot of cons and people get to know them, but they're not putting out books. And, you know, end of the day, what it comes down to is, yeah, you're a writer. And a lot of that other stuff, like meeting other writers and doing some of that con stuff, like it's really fun, but that's not my job. So my job isn't to have fun, and it isn't to like make connections. It's to write books. They're great. So I've said no to some things, and I'm trying to focus to, you know, getting the next book done. Which you know, there's guys like Brandon Sanderson who just write all the time, and then they, you know, they write for fun on the weekends. You know, and like to me, writing is work. It's work I love, but it's work, and so. So I'm not writing 4,000 words a day like Brandon is. I'm like, man, 1,000 or 2,000 words is great. So that means I need to put in more days per week and do less cons. And
understood.
That's just me. So yeah, I wish I could do faster, do more, and do more things that are fun. But that's not what I got. That's not the equipment I have. So.
All right. Well, I think that's going to be it for tonight. I want to thank you, and of course, thank your family who's in the background there for letting you sit here with me for an hour.
My wife waves and says hi. Hi, Patrick. So,
you guys were awesome. Next time you come to Denver, let me know ahead of time, and I'll take you to Biker Jim to get you a gourmet hot dog.
Oh, really? That sounds very calorific of you. So, oh God, there's my phone in the background. So I guess that's it for us. How tacky of me. Well, thank you, Patrick. It's been a pleasure. All right, Patrick. Well, if there's anything I can do to help you out, let me know. Pleasure to talk with you.
And there you have it. My great interview with Brent Weeks. He's a great guy. Love him to death. And there at the end, my sound started to do what we affectionately call Cyloning. It's something that happens with Skype. We don't know why, but it's always at the same time. So you can kind of sort of set your watch by it. I didn't get a chance to tell you that or ask Brent about this, but his website, if you're interested, is brentweeks.com. And his books are available from Orbit. He is also on Twitter, twitter.com/Brent Weeks. And I think that's it for this week. Thanks for sticking around. I know this was a long podcast. Next week, I think we're going to have Sam Sykes on as our interview. So stay tuned to that. And, of course, check out sfsignal.com daily for all kinds of cool stuff. Thanks, everybody. Bye. I'm